were saying that if you were down to one armed fighter troop, you just have to get on with it anyway.
That's right, yes. So one car out is better than nothing. You know, you could fill in an area of 3 miles on the desert.
Yes.
You see, by one being there, you've still got the visibility and you've got the other troops either side too. Or probably they were down to two armoured cars, might have been down to one themselves, the other squadrons, because they were had about six. We probably might have had about 12 cars in the regiment by now. So it's... And as I say, I went on to Matt's car, but by now we were getting to the stage where we were really non-operational.
Because of the number of cars.
That's right, there. Yes. And then the colonel sent for me, Colonel Peter Byrne, and I had to go to headquarters, or his TAC headquarters, and he told me he wanted me to take over as WO2 in C Squadron, as Squadron Sergeant Major. So,
had you had any suspicions of that might be
no,
on the way?
No idea, because I was one of the most junior sergeants in the regiment. You know, I was probably the youngest, and there were sergeants who were sergeants when I joined the regiment.
Yeah.
Say at least half a dozen, and there was SQMSs, two or three of them in the regiment, who should have been there, you see. Yeah. And the colonel said I'd have to do it. So, of course, I was up in the front line, you see. So I said, yes, I'll do it. So I had no choice. He told me to do it, and that was it. And so I took over. I was sorry to leave the squadron, Matt, but... he was delighted for me. He said, oh, well done, you know, that sort of thing, you know. But he said, sorry, I'm going. But I thought it'd be a temporary measure and I'd be going back, you know, being in the front line and that sort of thing. And but eventually, when the time came, and I went to the colonel and said, well, you know, when the regiment all got back together again, and I went to the colonel and said, well, can I hand over now to somebody else and go back to my troop? He said, no. He said, you did it in the front line. You can do it now. You know, so that was it. I had no... And that was unfortunate, really, because a lot of the senior ones who'd gone back to base when their vehicles were destroyed or whatever, they'd gone back to base and were happy to be back there. I didn't go back to base. I stayed with my troop all the time. So... I wasn't getting all the luxury of Cairo and things like that. And so I had to point that out to them. You know, well, if you'd have stayed up, you'd have probably been there to do it. But you weren't, and the colonels told me to do it. And so I'm going to do it, and that's it. And, you know, it's a bit... But they came round to it eventually. But because I was only... Well, I'd only been in the army less than 5 years, and some of these people had been in 12 years and been sergeants for... Before the war, you had to spend a long time in the army before you became a sergeant. You know, no one under 12 years service would ever think about being a warrant officer. You know, so it was a bit, and I was still quite young, really. 22,
you,
I think.
I mean, did they show any signs of real resentment that you'd...
They did at first, but I said, well, I don't want the job. I'd much sooner go back and, you know, be with my troop, you know. So I said, if you've got any, you know, grouch about it, go to the squadron leader and complain, not me. You know, I've been told to do a job, and that's what I intend doing.
You know, did any of them go and complain?
No, they didn't. I don't think that would have done them any good, really, to have done so.
You said you went to the colonel's TAC headquarters. What was actually there? What did the TAC headquarters consist
probably a Jeep. I think he had an armored car, a couple of armored cars. Might have had one armored car, a one-ton truck, that sort of thing. You know, nothing much at all. Of course, he didn't want to make too big a target of himself. He'd have a couple of echelon vehicles, perhaps there. You know, but the main sort of pack of stuff, like the orderly room and all that sort of thing, would be back in B echelon. See, and then in front of that would be A echelon, which was the immediate echelon. And then you would have your fighting echelon with you, which would be a petrol lorry, ammunition lorry, that sort of thing.
Did he have a map table or other impedimental equipment?
Well, he'd have a big, not a big map table, he'd have a sort of fair-sized map on a board, you know, but nothing. It wouldn't be a setup of such. It'd be out of the back of a vehicle or at the side of the vehicle and that sort of thing. He wouldn't have any. I think he might have had a staff car, one of the Humber staff car type thing, but nothing really that would pick him out as a headquarters.
How many people would there be with him in his TAC HQ?
Let's see. There'd be his IO, signals officer. Might have the tech edge with him. Let's say half a dozen officers of different. Remy officer would be there, perhaps. Or if not with him, within sort of a.
Within a
shell. Yeah. And probably. Second command would be somewhere. Of course, he'd have his forward HQ, his forward link, and the rear link would be with the second in command on it, you see, going back to brigade. So there'd be those two. An IO.
Presumably, you'd have to have some signalers.
They're all regimental signalers then.
Yes, but
yeah.
As I say, regimental.
Oh, on his
on
sets.
HQ, yeah.
Oh, yeah, he'd have those. Well, like the same as an armored car, really. Same setup it would be. And one or two extra vehicles, a one-ton truck, or his staff car, a Jeep. Might be the technical agent might be with him, or he might be back at B echelon. It depends. He might be floating.
What was the technical agent? What was his job?
His job was responsible for the, well, reliable... reliability of the vehicles to the colonel. He would control repairs and stuff like that. It was later taken over by the Remy. He and the Remy officer would work together to decide which vehicles had priority, and he would keep the colonel informed about the state of the vehicles. And he would arrange for the backloading of the vehicles if he could, any damaged vehicles. And he would then also arrange for fresh vehicles coming up. It's that sort of job.
So it's managing the fleet.
That's right, yeah.
Armored cars.
Yeah, yeah. I had that job with tanks as technical agent. And your job, too, to make sure all the petrol in conjunction with the quartermaster to make sure that the petrol would get up, see, and the quartermaster also, the quartermaster's job too was to make sure the ammunition got up, you know, they all sort of worked together.
It's part of the, it's really like being part of the management team.
That's right, yeah, yes.
What were your new duties as WO2?
Well, in peacetime, it had been sort of more discipline.
Yes.
But in wartime, really, you look after the interests of the squadron, to start with. Again, you would be used. I didn't have an armoured car then, because we didn't have any. But I had a one-ton truck. But the job would be, once you've got an armoured car, you could be used as a patrol, a single patrol again, you see.
One man
one man job, and you'd be dispatched on different jobs. Like if on occasions the supply vehicles were missing, or they were due to come up, but they'd got lost or something, you would find out where they were over the radio, and I would then go out and meet them and bring them in. And all sorts of jobs like that. Any job like, or if there's like I later I'll come on to it, where an armoured car had been destroyed and the men were wounded, I went and took the ambulance to where the vehicle was destroyed and get the wounded men in onto the ambulance, and if necessary lead them to the spot where the doctor was or whatever. Any job that came up, you would get on and do.
Sounds like your job was really that of a sort of troubleshooter.
That's right.
Dealing with things ad hoc.
That's right, yes.
So it's not so much the normal regular.
Oh no, there was no set
duty
really. Apart from that, you made sure the squadron was moved out of Liga first thing in the morning, and that everyone was awake and could move out full first light. That was one of the main things, that the first thing, that was a regular thing to do to make sure everybody was out.
Does that mean you had to be the first man out of bed in the morning?
Oh yes.
How did you manage to contrive that? Did you have an alarm clock or something?
No, but we always, when we had when we were in close Liga, you'd always have one man on patrol round.
That's squadron leader.
Squadron leader.
So one man on sentry.
That's right. And he'd walk round the squadron when they were all closed in, you see. And that would be one man. And that was my job then to detail who would do it. So it would be like two troop, you do first shift, 2 hours. You wake up, three troop, he does it for 2 hours. Wake up 4 troop, he does it for 2 hours. And that sort of thing is like an ordinary guard roster. And whoever was the last man on would
I
tell him what time to wake me in good time to make sure I can make sure the rest of the squad gets up and out. Not so much as waking up. More importantly, move, and get them spread out.
How did you do that? Did you just go around and give them a shake?
Yeah. Get to the troop's arms. Say, come on. Get your troop out. And then if they weren't moving, I'd go around and chivvy them. Get out, sort of really give them a stick until they were moved out. That sort of thing, you see. And then if the colonel or the squad leader would say, oh, so-and-so, you'd get on and do it. There was no set thing. There was no, as you imagine, the squadrons aren't major, sort of, in peacetime, sort of getting people up and disciplines and sort of do your buttons up and things like that. That's not. It wasn't anything like that at all. It was complete. I didn't know what to expect. It was just a matter. I got into what I thought was right, a thing to do.
Who was your squadron commander?
The first one was Arthur Gemmell, and then later it became Bruce Shand, who's a great chap. I'll come on to him later on.
I mean, did they operate their squadron the same way as the previous squadron you've been in?
Oh yes, they were all much the same. And that squadron leader, I'd been his sergeant operator in France in 1939.
So you already knew him?
I knew him quite well, and he knew me. And as I say, that was quite well. And of course, I knew all the officers anyway. And most, I knew all the men, because having grown up with the regiment, certainly all the NCOs and lots of the new men who sort of reinforcements I didn't, but you soon got to know them.
Was the regiment at that time still
But there's still quite a lot of regulars there. Tremendous amount, especially there were a lot of reservists, sort of excellent hussars and 12th lancers, and there were still quite a large number of those amongst the NCOs, and they were good men, so very steady, all much older. I mean, probably most of them were, say, near enough 10 years older than me, but they were all good, reliable men. And I suppose a lot of the soldiers were the Belisha boys, were they? Then was it Belisha the call up, or
yeah.
Some were Belisha, and a lot of them were.
Well, I was going to ask whether the regiment had, you know, whether most of the people coming into it, reinforcements, were conscript, or whether any of them were actually volunteers who.
Oh, I think a lot either volunteers or conscripts. I never really knew whether they had volunteers or they were conscripts. No, there'd be no difference. They came and they were. A lot of them, those sort of people, joined. Before we came out to the desert, sort of round about when we were at Reigate,
yes.
We had a lot of these people. Yeah, but all, you know, pretty good men. All sort of, a good age. They weren't sort of these sort of lads who were irresponsible. They all seemed quite sensible, older type of men.
So adults.
Adults, yeah. And they were good. Mm.
The other thing is that you were saying that you couldn't get the armoured cars in the desert when they knocked out or they broke down, couldn't get them replaced, but you never seemed short of men. Did you get a trickle of reinforcements to replace your casualties as you were?
Oh yes, when they came and you saw the odd one arrive, who was sort of, he's got no battle experience, you know, and especially amongst the officers too. So what used to happen with the officers, if they were a new officer, they'd be put with a troop sergeant, and he would be his gunner.
The officer would act as the gunner.
That's right, yeah. And occasionally he might go with a troop leader, but it was always sort of with the troops armed, and for a while, until he sort of learned his role, because a lot of the troops armed were doing troop leader anyway. Some went all through the desert, you know, commanding a troop, as opposed to an officer being in it. It's quite a number.
Because they were always short of officers.
Yes. Mm. And of course the sergeants too were experienced and became good troop leaders. That all comes with experience, really.
Was the regiment carrying on with normal patrolling and wrecking when you were?
Yes. Only for a short time, very short time, because we were on the 21st of January. Rommel launched his attack, and he occupied the Wadi Brewery. And he took Brewery and was heading for the airfields at Masseuse and the Mediterranean ports, which would be Benghazi, and then he'd go on to Brook if he could. So
did his attack come through in your area?
Well, it came on the whole of that front, really, with columns coming, you see. It wasn't sort of a case of a. Because it's so vast. You know, it's difficult, I think, for a lot of people to imagine the desert. And, you know, you get one column coming, and there'd be nothing for 10, 50 mile either side of it. But you knew jolly well that that's where the attack was coming, you see, and there'd be another column coming up a bit further, and that sort of thing. And they'd come in columns, so you had nothing to do but to drop back, or if you were cut off, you'd go forward and then come back.
Behind them?
That's right, and that's how we used to...
Did you spot them on their way in to the attack?
You could see them, yeah. You'd see them coming, and then the only thing you could do, because you had nothing you could stop them with, you'd have to sort of come back and keep reporting, you know, the column so-and-so is at so-and-so, and you'd give them the map reference of where the head of the column was. But you'd see the long column coming.
Was there any sort of preliminary bombardment before the...
No, you get the ordinary sort of shells that we've been used to, because there's nothing really that they had to bombard, apart from the infantry, the odd infantry position. By then, the infantry would have up and gone, because they knew they'd have their orders and no good standing there to defend the thing, because they'd just be bypassed and then they'd be cut off completely. So it'd be pointless trying to defend anything like that. It was just a matter of withdrawal. And
so you've been CSM for a short while, haven't you, when
yes.
the attack came in?
Yes. And then on the 22nd of January, we stopped at Masseuse.
So you'd fallen back?
Then. Yeah, to Masseuse.
What were you doing? What was your role during this withdrawal? Were you supposed to be screening or just...
We were dropping back. We were in tow. By now, another regiment had taken over the in front of us. So we were now relieved.
So the regiment was now being put into reserve.
That's right. We were going back to refit. But we'd got as far as Masseuse. And And we stayed at Masseuse until the 25th, for some reason or other.
Did you get any refitting?
No.
Did you have any sort of defence role or anything of that sort?
No, we were just sort of...
Just hanging about?
Yeah, just... probably we got there on the night of the 22nd, stayed the 23rd, 24th, sorting ourselves out, I think. And then on the 25th, a German column came down, and that was the time I think I have already told you when we were in the back of a lorry in a conference, and the Stukas came over. 18 Stukas dive bombed the regiment there, and we were in the back of a 3-tonner having a conference. And someone shouted Stukas, and everyone dived out with dug slit trenches around, into slit trenches. And by then, it was the time when I was getting very edgy, having been bombed so much, that I felt if I jumped into a slit trench, you know, my nerve would have cracked. So I ran, I suppose about 50 yards perhaps, and the bombs were coming down. I knew there was a gun pit, but I could see it. I knew it was there because I'd had it put there. And I ran to it and jumped over the parapet in as the bombs were, and the planes were coming down, and just fired the gun. And I felt so much better. And I'm sure that saved me from going a bit...
Saying bomb happy.
Yeah.
What sort of gun was it? Just a brain gun.
Yeah, and that was. I knew it was there, and I knew that having mag in it and a box of ammunition at the side, you know, that was. So I thought, right, I'm getting there, and did it, and that did me the world of good. Didn't shoot any of the 18 planes down mine, but that made me feel better.
Did they do any serious damage?
No. They dropped the bombs, but there was no. I think there might have been a vehicle or two settled light or something, but there was no deaths. So that was the last bit we had. And then the tanks were there was a tank column coming down as well, so we had to get out of it pretty quick.
Did you go out? Did you have another car that time?
No, I still only had a 1-ton truck. Yeah. because I have nothing else there. And that was just after the attack, when the enemy tanks were approaching. To Missouri's airfield, so then we had to get out of there pretty quick.
It sounds like the enemy were attacked. It was quite well coordinated because we've described it. There was a dive bombing attack.
Yeah.
And then the enemy tanks arrived.
That's right. Just shortly afterwards.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It seems obvious that Stukas were bombing ahead of the column.
That's right. And bombing the airfield.
Yeah. Soften up anything.
That's right. So we anyway we made off pretty quickly, and we finished up at Makili, and then we got a heavy downpour of rain, which was.
Is that unusual in the desert?
It was, yeah. Very, I mean, we could have welcomed that a month earlier.
But not then.
But no. But it's amazing, really. And once or twice when it really rained hard on the desert, you know, and
what effect did that have on your activity?
Well, it slowed down a lot, you see. It made the tracks, if there was any tracks, sort of boggy, and that happened just after Alamein, that we were bogged down. So, a chance to get a tremendous amount of his stuff away. You probably know that anyway.
Because just when you started the pursuit at Alamein,
the rains came
so
for about 3 days, and that it slowed up the advance tremendously. Well, we got back to Makili, and we had this heavy downpour of rain, and then we got into Egypt on the 3rd of February and finished up at Bir Tahat. Tahatpur, I think. And established a camp there.
Just a regimental camp.
Yeah. And gallons of water, a good wash, cleaning clothes, you know, really getting back to civilization again.
But it sounds to me as though you were in need of it, because of what you were saying earlier on, you're not in very good health. Back,
oh yeah, but that was all. Everyone was still fit and active. We had these things which we took then as part of life. I had scabies, and I wouldn't go back to hospital. What I got was germaline, and I used to all up here was all one rash.
Your shoulder.
Yeah, and underneath here and. If it had been, if I'd reported, I'd have gone straight back to hospital, but I didn't want to. So I used to have tins of Zambuk, I think was the stuff, and I used to rub that on. And of course, with the sand and the dirt and all that, you know, it couldn't have been doing it much good. But it eventually cured. I never went into hospital for it. But, and a great big desert sore on my leg, because we weren't getting the right food. See, there was nothing in just bully beef and biscuits. We were having no vitamins or anything like that, and we were pretty run down, you know. And there, a lot of people had desert sores, a lot of people had crabs, you know, and they used to douse themselves down in petrol and wash in petrol. But that was we accepted this. We weren't sort of going sick or anything like that. We just sort of like, we've got to be here. We can't.
How long did it take for those things to clear up once you got back into?
Oh, they. Oh, I should say 6 weeks. You know, once you could wash every day properly and clean yourself and that sort of thing. I never had lice, but the darker people seem to get lice. Squad leader got crabs, and they used to wash him, so he used to swear like mad about it, you know. A lot of them had the desert sores on their legs more than anywhere, and jaundice was another thing that I think that came later. A lot of people used to get jaundice. But
probably due partly to a bad diet.
Probably, yes. But